Cinephiles, audiophiles, ladies and germs, welcome to the Film Cult Podcast. Tonight, it's a cinematographer behind two of Spike Lee's newest films, Passover and Black Klansman. And, of course, he's the director of photography, cinematographer behind the amazing new film, Blonde, out on Netflix. And now, from Andrew Dominic, that cinematographer, it's Chase Irvin. Chase, how are things?
They're good. They're good. Yeah. I've been traveling a bit, and now I'm finally home for a week or so, and then I start traveling again. So, but it's nice to be home.
Excellent.
Yeah.
I want to like kind of delve into your past a little bit and kind of how it's affected your future, because do you think that music videos and commercials have kind of helped you with working with such cutting edge filmmakers like Spike and Andrew?
Yeah, I do think the type of stuff that I was doing in commercials and music videos were more auteur in the sense that it was the director's medium or piece. It wasn't like the music video was edited by a committee of people, you know? So it was sort of like emulating the what goes on in the film world. And then I was meeting our tour directors sort of through that, because I think, you know, they can detect those things in the work that they view. So they could sense that. But my choice to do commercials and music videos sort of came out of a need to protect myself in the feature film realm, because when I was quite young, I could see that I could see how some of those choices may not be made. I mean, choices in terms of what film to do were made based off of your connection to the director or material itself. They were made because of you needed shelter and sustenance to survive. And I thought that was really sad. So I decided to start exploring commercials and music videos, because I've actually kind of came off the precipice of a film that I really wanted to do failing. And that the day before it happening, the plug got pulled. And I prepped it for 3 months and it didn't happen. And I'd worked on films prior to that, that, you know, I shot a few movies before I actually had created my debut, I guess is what you would call it. The film A Days is a debut that I did because it was accepted into international film festivals. But prior to that, I learned a lot about filmmaking through making these really tiny movies, and some of them never were released or went anywhere. And others, you know, they were screened at Slam Dancer, things like that, like small festivals, but weren't accepted internationally. So it was sort of like in that, in the growing period in my like early mid 20s, when I was doing these films, in some cases, I could see how the making of the film was a much less artistic endeavor than I had hoped. It was actually more, it was more formulaic, and I disliked that. And so I had a real desire to rebel, but I wasn't getting the offers to express my values on a film without interference. I wasn't getting those films offered to me where I'm able to do that, such as Blonde or such as any of the films that I've done of recent. So I decided to maybe pivot and try that in commercials and music videos. And it was actually quite accepted. I would do things like that were quite rebellious and sort of defied the desires of the client or whoever. And because I was only being hired for a few days, it didn't really bother me that much. You know what I mean? So, but here's a small example. Like, there was a period where you could shoot a commercial on an anamorphic lens, but you would always ask the client if, anamorphic or spherical. Well, to me, that's like an absurd question for the to ask them because they have no idea. And if they whoever presents it to them is going to say it in a way like it does this and it doesn't do that, and it's sort of like it's fear-inducing. So I would just show up with the lenses that I liked without telling anyone, and they would be like, "Oh, it's amazing!" And then, but it's an anamorphic lens that was never discussed, and all this stuff. But I was breaking protocols and doing things like that. I would do things like where I would submit a list with spherical lenses, then I would go to the camera prep, swap them to anamorphic, just so they wouldn't know that what I was doing. And part of me always thought I was going to get fired for that shit, but I never did because I felt like in the end, I felt like they always received it as a gift. They were sort of really glad and happy. And so it was I guess what I'm trying to get at is that in some ways, that space that I was inhabiting early on really nourished my identity, I think.
I'm glad that you mentioned lenses because do you find yourself always like wanting like maybe just shoot on one very specific style of lens? Like do you always have a base package that it doesn't matter kind of what director you're working with, you're thinking from that as a base level, or does it really do change every single time that you work on a new project?
It does and it doesn't. I'm torn about it because I actually have always, I felt in some ways, even now, I feel repulsed at the fetish, the fetishizing of lenses. To me, when I think of lenses, I'm actually thinking more field of view. For example, like a 40 mil or a 30, a 29 mil or a 30 mil or 32 mil. Like, what angle and perspective does that create for the spectator to sort of travel into the story? And what accentuates movement and what doesn't accentuate movement? However, there's a plethora of things, characters that lenses have that are, some are called, flare. Internal reflections, halation, chromatic or spherical aberration. Like there's all these characters that sort of help. They contribute to it. But to be honest with you, the things that I've shot that I felt most connected to, I just shot whatever lens. I used to own a set of lenses called the Master Primes, and I would shoot a lot of stuff on those. And I shot it not because of the characters of the lenses, really. It was more they had the focal lengths that I liked, and they were fast. They had the Master Prime specifically were T1.3, which actually was much more in service to how I'd like to shoot, which is using a sense of spontaneity. And I never wanted some technical thing to inhibit my desire to act in the moment of inspiration, and those lenses supported that just on a technical level. It wasn't a creative, artistic one or texture or any of that stuff. So I'm sort of torn about it in some ways. Like I was talking to somebody yesterday, like ideal in some ways, I romanticize the idea of someone just handing me a set of lenses and being like, this is what you're shooting. And then I'd have to figure it out and I'd react. And that those lenses would be a source of inspiration for me in a discovery process rather than me really like preconceiving and sort of creating these, each lens acts as a symbol of some kind. Like I admire a photographer. His name's Ouija. He went by Ouija the Famous. He's long past dead, but he was a photojournalist. He shot mafia murders in New York and stuff like that. But he had this saying where it was called, I think it goes, F8 and be there. And he's talking about the aperture. And just, but what was important to him was being there. And he would go to these, he would have like a police scanner and he would hear about a call and he would get there before the police would get there and he would get a photograph and he knew exactly how far away to stand, how bright his flash was. He would preset probably the focus and the aperture, and it was just about him getting there before anything else happened. And I like that. In some ways, my the sort of the music video world that I worked in with Khalil Joseph was much more like that. He created these events that were always like continuously feeding me things to respond to that I had never preconceived, and he likely never preconceived. He just sort of knew how to set a scene up that it would always be delivering things. So it was much more like I was acting as I was more in the role of a photojournalist, or like some of these like fine art photojournalists, I believe, like they'll find something that's speaking to them because it has a geometric form or it has something in the frame that actually creates a structure. But then they sort of camp there and they wait for that structure to also express another form of composition, which is the humanity of the moment, the emotional composition. So they find these the sort of they find the first realm, the where it creates a form, and then they wait until something happens that, and it's sort of like that when I work with Khalil, it's much more. But that's why I go into that F8 and it be there. It's much more about being there and setting up a way of shooting where you can respond to things and act on them kind of intuitively without thought. So that's sort of the limits of my consideration on lenses.
Well, I'm glad that you mentioned technology as a hindrance because do you think that we're at a level of low light with camera technology that you're kind of happy with right now, or do you always find yourself trying to push that limit even further?
Like you're talking about the sensitivity of a camera.
Yeah.
Part of me does believe that the technological advancements in my world are happening at such an interval that it's many people think of it as avant-garde to, or it has been in the past, to leap on the next technology and always be at the cutting edge of that. But I actually think we're in a moment where doing that is completely not avant-garde anymore because everyone's doing it. It's actually the reverse. If you go and you start shooting things on film and composing them in very classic ways, it's like way more avant-garde. And I like that. So in this sense of when I think of sensitivity, again, I think of it as how I guess in my mind, I always render it of like how would I like get to look in regardless of that, and then I augment it. I did shoot one commercial earlier this year where we were hoisting a dancer into the sky off a construction crane, and he was there was a couple dancers, and they were flying up a tower, and what I used is an array of 18Ks. There must have been 6 to 8 of them at the back of this church lighting the sky. And it created a gradient as if the twilight is coming. And you could see the silhouette of these characters flying against the sky. And I was only able to do that with a camera of extreme sensitivity. It was the Venice 2. And I think that went up to 3200 ISO, and I probably cranked it to 6400, and I wouldn't have been able to do that, or probably cranked it way higher than that, to be honest with you, probably like 12. I don't even know what the maximum was, I cranked it to its max. And, you know, I'm grateful to that camera to allow me to discover that. So yeah, it's, yeah, I don't know. A lot that goes into cinematography in some ways, and like the understanding of lighting is actually augmentation. You can't create, or you get a sense of what is being motivated either through practical or natural light, and you just augment it to create a depth, or a stop, or some, you know, react to the film stock that you're using. Likely right now, there's window light, and I'm quite close to the window, but it's quite a dark day in New York. And if I was shooting this and I was doing a scene here in a continuous way, I would have to use, or I would like to consider using, big sources from outside the window, kind of far away, coming in, so that I can create a sort of a continuous, look throughout the whole scene, because it would be really tragic if the light changed at one point, like it does in natural light, and then you start dealing with editorial issues. So it's not necessarily something that I think about that often, to be honest with you. It's the sensitivity. But I could see how in my recent history it's become a virtue, some of the technological advancements.
Do you find yourself really, I guess, resorting back to something like the 18 or the 20K and like dealing with the HMI or any of that kind of a light? Or do you find yourself, I guess, embracing that LED technology and trying to work with that from now on?
I do both. Like, anything that's close to the actors is LED. Anything that's far away, the only thing that can really contend with augmenting natural light, I think, are HMIs and large incandescents. Like, if I was creating a sun-like source through this room, which would be very hard if the person stepped into it, but also very soft if it bounced off the ground. I would use a incandescent. There is no LED that can contend with recreating a quality, but also an intensity. So usually when I consider building like a lighting package with the gaffer, it will be you know, a series of HMIs and incandescents that are for day exterior or day interior, really, day exterior, that are big guns, and they're likely going to be far away. So big sources from far away. And then anything that's on the set that's close to the actors will be an LED. And the reason for that is because I use wireless, and I don't. You know, there's always these adjustments that need to be made when the actors come back to set after rehearsals because they've changed something. You know, maybe they move to a different part of the room than you had anticipated. Well, stopping and bringing in equipment or changing things around, if that can be handled simply through a dimmer, then I'll use that, and it creates a. It sort of preserves this the sanctity of the set when the actors come on. It's like their zone, and you know. So you try to. I'm trying to work with tools in that way, but there's one company that I've worked with for a very long time. It's called Lightgear. I use their LEDs. When I first moved to Los Angeles in 2009, I became. Friends with a gaffer named John Tower, and John Tower owned a company called Lux Lighting, and his partner was another gaffer named Mike Bauman, and they all shared a shop with Lightgear when Lightgear was first producing some of its early products, which were really just LED ribbon with flicker-free dimmers. And so I was introduced kind of like to that technology right at its infancy. And adopted it, and I've grown up with it kind of continuously. So I almost use their lighting tools exclusively in terms of LED. Like, I don't really use, I can't even remember the last time I used a light called a sky panel, which sort of is like the light that most people use nowadays, because it's a great workhorse, but I don't use color as often. I don't understand the unit. It sort of reminds me of a zip light. Like, I don't like it how it looks when it's bounced. I don't like how it looks when it's direct. It's and using layers of diffusion, it just sort of like complicates things for me. Whereas the Lightyear stuff, it serves my need for a particular quality of light, the size, and there's another company, Hudson Spider, that makes a unit that I like a lot too, because it's super white, lightweight, and I could put it on boom arms and create sources from particular directions without it being a rigging situation. So it's sort of that. It's all about, like, for me, a lot of times lighting in general is about how do I set it up in a way that it looks natural, or not necessarily natural, but augments what's happening nat what to the setting, what feels natural to the setting. But I can act on things in that moment of inspiration too. Like, if I have an idea, I can do it. So I like to work with lighting units that kind of come to me intuitively. And yeah, basically, to be honest with you, when I figure out sort of when I solve that puzzle of how I'm going to light it, it's kind of more of a rinse and repeat process. Like, I'm not trying to come up with novel techniques each time of how to light something. Once I figure out the language, I speak that language continuously. So it's much more intuitive. It doesn't require much thinking at all.
There's a lot of total contrast in Blonde. Was that something that was really discussed early on in prep between you and Andrew, or did that maybe come a little bit when you guys got on set?
No, that came from, it wasn't like a, basically, we were talking about different film stocks that existed, like Tri-X, which is a reversal films black and white film stock. And we tried to find a LUT that would create that look. And we found one that even the curve was quite interesting and weird. It sort of bubbled in the bottom end of it. Like, the curve kind of goes like this, but it has like a little bit of a like a cancer cell almost, where it created this like noise that really looked like black, like Tri-X to me. And then the way it dealt with the highlights was really not as smooth. It couldn't handle some of the stuff. It was always breaking. So it had this thing that I liked about it, which reversal has. I'm sort of like that, honestly. Like, I like the traditional method of post-production in film. Like, you would pick a negative, and then you would pick a positive stock, and the combination of the two would then really, the only way to deviate from that was the printer lights, but the lighting. And so once I made the choice of the Tri-X and the LUT, I lit specifically to that continuously. And in the final film, the basically what we were monitoring on set, the dailies and the DI, the final finish, were the same. I don't think we changed anything at all. It was basically how I shot it, exactly how it was presented. So I like those kind of choices. And when they're like, even if they have a flaw in some way and it's not as smooth as I think we would like, I see that as a virtue, because I like things to be less than perfect.
Well, when you send dailies back to somebody like Company 3 in New York, Are you trying to color correct right away and make those notes immediately? Or do you kind of wait for, I guess, production to be wrapped before you even start delving into that? Even though it sounds like Blonde, a lot of it was shot is directly, you didn't really even touch that much.
Yeah, I think honestly, the way that it works in my mind is that color grading is about recreating the intentions of the time of capture. So it's more me recording in my own mind what I would have liked when I was making it. And a lot of times I hit that mark perfectly, but then other times, because of different constraints or time or whatever, I wasn't able to. And then when I go into the DI, I'll negotiate coercing that in an artificial way. But oftentimes it's a failure because I really believe that there's a particular point in which the footage breaks and it's actually bringing out a lot of artifacts that are difficult to perceive. But I can see them. All of a sudden, the image doesn't feel right anymore. So I try to always stay true to what I was doing and what my intentions were and what I ended up with. And I learned that process actually from a dailies colorist that I work with, Benny Estrada. He works at Company 3, but at the time, the company was called eFilm. And Benny and I go back to like 2009 or whatnot, and I would shoot something, and I would sit down with him, and I'd look at it, and we'd spend like 2 hours kind of fucking with the footage and trying to make it something unique or like trying to find some novel thing that it could present. And to be honest with you, always in the end, we went back to what Benny had done before I walked in the room, and it became a great learning lesson to me that really, simple is the hardest thing to achieve in any art. And Benny just had that down. He was just always simple. He would just use printer points. He was working on a color correction system called a luster, which used its technology to emulate the traditional photochemical way of grading. I mean, it had like, things like windows and stuff like that, or it still had. But really, it was like we would just talk in terms of like print it up or print it down, get 4 points red, 3 points green. And it was just like simple stuff like that. Like we never really saw it as this. But anyway, what I'm trying to get at is I learned my lesson kind of early on when working with Benny, and that there's something really precious about a lack of manipulation. And it makes it a little bit more daunting, the onset experience, because you know that what your intentions are there are super precious and need to be maintained kind of throughout. So you're sort of like, you're committing to things in that moment. And yeah, I mean, that's sort of my philosophy around it. I don't want to recreate. I don't want, like, there's sort of a fix it in post philosophy that's been integrated into color grading now. And I sort of am repulsed, or I try to rebel against that because I feel like it's so inundated. Even the term fix it in post, I think it would be rejected if you mentioned it, but it's like completely the system which they work within. And even the whole concept of identity in the colorist as well, like they would have a signature and they would bring that signature in. And but I think that contributes to the homogenization of all these films kind of looking the same. Like for the long, I don't watch much of Netflix aside from Blonde, and it's not a knock on Netflix, but I remember when I would view it in the past, it's a lot of the films that would sort of look the same to me. They didn't actually have like, they weren't they weren't really grabbing me and shaking me and being like, we're making something here. So, I try to apply my philosophy in a specific way regarding all these little facets.
Do you find yourself still being influenced by new artists?
Yes, at the moment, it's actually outside of the cinema realm. I'm trying to revisit it right now. Like I watched Triangle of Sadness the other night at home. I fucking loved it. I thought it was hysterical, and it was like really commenting on even like neoliberalism and like just conversations that I have with myself often. It actually spoke to, and then its ability to use a sense of naturalism yet be absurd, I thought was really beautiful. Because not every filmmaker does that. Like, there's some absurd things happening in that film, but he presents them with naturalism. So it actually becomes even weirder, uncomfortable to watch at moments, but then also hysterical because of the irony. And so yeah, there's like stuff like that that I've watched, or I'm sort of getting into now as of this week. But other than that, in the for the last few years, it's actually the most inspiration I've gotten has been from like a visit to a museum or discussing something with somebody, sort of more relationship that I've had with others. I worked on a project this summer with Charlie Kaufman, and the way his mind works really stimulated me. And his friend Ava HD is the poet that he's who writes poetry for the films that he's done in the past. She's another Canadian and just has the language and an enthusiasm that really is mysterious to me and fun to be around. And so I get inspiration from those people in a way, you know.
I'm glad you mentioned our home country because I wanted to ask you how much did the Canadian climate really play into, I guess, the world that you look at the world and how you try to look at the world through a lens?
It's difficult for me to answer that because I don't know if I can clearly define the identity of a Canadian. I know that here's an example of how it's informed my life choices. When I was growing up, my parents converted to Taoism. And in my community growing up in Canada, there is a lot of Taiwanese and Hong Kongese people that have immigrated there. And we were a member of the community of those people, so that's uniquely Canadian just off the bat, because there's not, that existing in LA. Like, LA is actually way more segregated than I think even people can perceive there. Whereas in Vancouver or Toronto, it's completely intermixed, in my opinion. Like, you can, it's really, really multiracial. And so I have this sort of, I grew up with this kind of like philosophy of Taoism, which I use in my craft. Specifically, one of the tenets is called Wu Wei, which is translates to actionless action or non-action. But really, the way I see it that can be communicated to others is flow state. Because that's sort of the Western version of the word. It's sort of you act in a way that's free of thought. And I really believe that. I feel like if you delve too deep into thought, you're going into neurosis and you're starting to interact with things that aren't really real. And those things that aren't really real only respond to an area of the brain that is, or any thought that comes out of your brain can only go through the process of memory. So you can never actually see, experience, or see, or conceive of anything new. Things that are new happen to you. And the only way you can see and react to the new things is through Wu Wei, the flow state, where it's actionless. You're completely responding to things spontaneously, almost continuously, and interacting with them in a level of relationship. And those kind of things that I learned through my family and my community in Canada, I cherish very much. And in that way, to answer your question, that would be the Canadian inside me, which is really like a culture of accepting others, to be honest with you. Like the fact that my community growing up was part Anglo-Saxon, part African American, part Persian, and then part Taiwanese is extremely unique. So it was really just like accepting everybody for who they are and not really judging based off of a stereotype, because I never grew up with those stereotypes at all. I like basketball, and the guys that played basketball were Taiwanese and Persian, you know what I mean? And it was just like you grow up with that, whereas I think in other places in the world, it's more divided, and you sort of create labels for people. But where I grew up, we were all just human beings, you know. There wasn't cultural divides.
Well, what can we expect from you coming up?
I'm sort of altering my view a bit as an artist. My ambition is sort of all changing, and it's difficult to navigate, but I think at its core, I really do want to work on things that are kind of expressions of my own freedom, to be honest with you. And it's difficult to find that stuff because those projects are rare. The industry sort of like making a film is such a speculative investment. The people who are financing it really have no idea if there's a formula for success or not. And the things that become successful, you really, there's sort of like an idea that you use these analytics and you can create a film that's good based off of certain aesthetic strategies, even like in my realm, like shallow depth of field or soft lighting. And if you check mark these things in your images, you will have a beautiful image. But I always feel like there's that list of things that you're check marking to in history is always being added on to. And there's somebody who's kind of divergent in their thinking that can add to that because they're exploring some scary space that they are interested in. And I think that's sort of the realm that I'd like to go into, is sort of like confronting some of my fears in terms of what it means to be a cinematographer, and sort of taking ideas that are in the consensus of cinematographers beautiful and flipping them and sort of going in the opposite direction. Like even some of the stuff in Blonde that I was doing with front lighting scenes with the, like to me that there's something, I liked that idea a lot. It was novel in the sense that I hadn't done it before, but to see that narratively kind of whole scenes with these front lights and the background getting so dark, like it fucked with the sense of spatial clarity. So it was motivated in a narrative sense and the psychological state of the character, but it was also violating a sort of rule that I think exists in cinematography. And I liked the results of it a lot. And it's sort of like exploring. It took some bravery to do that. And I thank Andrew for pushing me in that way. And I'm sort of wanting to continue on that path fearlessly. But to be honest with you, it's not a technique or an idea or a philosophy you just talk.
Sorry, that was very annoying.
Oh, you're
You were
muted.
just. Oh, am I? How's this?
Yeah, that's good. Okay.
Sorry about that. But you were just saying the philosophy.
I think it's not a philosophy that you can apply to anything. It's like a particular project that offers a space to do that. And that's the thing that's really hard to navigate. Because it goes down not to just even the director's intent, it's how it's being produced as well, which is vastly more creative than I think people think it is. In fact, some of the directors that I think do the most avant-garde filmmaking produce their films in a unique way. It's being like even goes back to Stanley Kubrick, like there's stories of how many crew members he had on the set. It was very small, but he would shoot over an extended period, and he wouldn't need a lot of money, but he would shoot kind of in this meticulous way and do many takes of things. Like the way he's making the film is unique. He's not adhering to a commercial formula of how a movie should be produced. And that kind of film is really rare because it makes it very difficult to produce it. Because a lot of them, you can't really go off a spreadsheet and line items. You're always pivoting all the resources around to serve the need of that moment. And it makes it really challenging. So, finding those projects or being asked requests to getting the request to work on them is really hard, you know.
Are you, I guess, hopeful for the future? Do you see this as an uptrend right now? Or do you see it as kind of like the Arturs come out every once in a while and it's really not escalating to the way that it needs to be yet?
I'm torn about it. In a way, I feel like everything is happening the way it should, for sure. I don't have control over a lot of that stuff. I would like to see a more of a renaissance in the sense that there's a real desire and push amongst the artistic community to challenge each other to push things to a different realm. And I don't see that as happening as much as I think it has in the past, you know? But I don't always, in some ways, I don't know if that's always the sort of the innovative artist more than it is the way it's being financed and produced. For example, one of the philosophies that I use to select projects is based off of the concept of positive and negative liberty, which was something that a philosopher named Isaiah Berlin sort of discussed in his work or created the concept of. And I might mix it up, but the idea is that negative liberty is freedom without constraints. Or sorry, freedom of interference. So you're not being interfered with by outside sources, such as a movie studio or a producer. So you have a freedom that you can explore in that realm. But then the positive liberty is the freedom to act on your free will because you have the resources to do that. So, and there's two different things, and sometimes they're in conflict with each other. I might get offered a movie that's like Black Panther or something, but I know that I won't have the, I'll get the positive liberty, but I'm not going to get the negative liberty because the investment's too large and too speculative, and they need to protect that. But then I can work on a small film that there is no interference, independently financed, and they want to nourish this sort of maverick inside me so that I can go into places that are unknown. But then they don't get the resources to act on my free will. So I'm, in a way, I'm being stifled in both realms. So the best projects are always the ones that have both, but they're very, very rare. Blonde was one of them. It had the resources to act because it, you know, it's always tight budget and whatever. It's never like it's just raining money. But they had the resources to create a period. They had the resources to create a shooting schedule that was appropriate. Yeah, still tight, but appropriate enough. And then Andrew has a uniquely strong will and does not let anyone fuck with anything that he wants to happen. And if you try to, it's an all-out war with him, you know? So it's like now and he's my bodyguard. So now I'm given this negative liberty. So that's one of those unique situations where you're working on a film where you're given both. To certain degrees, it's not like 100% both, but it's like they're both there and they're balancing each other equally. And finding those films is really rare because there's really only a handful made every year, maybe like four or five.
How similar do you feel Andrew and Spike are, and how their, I guess, approach to making each project was?
I think they were, it was like working with completely opposites, to be honest with you. But they both have equal integrity. Their just approaches were completely different. Andrew's, I think even Andrew shares like a sign or a birthday with like Che Guevara. You know what I'm saying? Like that's sort of the type of guy that he is in his heart. You know, you would be like a rebel leader in a country, a foreign country. He's charming. But he's also like, yeah, he can be deceptive. Whatever he needs to do to make it happen in the way that he intends it, he will do. Spike is more, he's kind of straight up about things. He's actually much more a family guy than I think people perceive him as. They sort of see a character. Spike's like a massive celebrity. He's probably one of the most famous guys in the world. Just me walking around with him in New York, just continuously people leaning out their windows, shouting at him, like, Spike, what up, Spike? And, you know, he is in an artistic realm. He is actually a character. He's performing a character. Spike Lee is a character. Like that's he goes to these games and he goes to these events. Like that's Spike Lee. But then there's also this other guy who's like just a family guy and cares about his kids and his wife more than anything else, you know? So it was a completely different experience working with either artist, but they're both definitely have a ton of integrity, artistic integrity.
Living in New York now, music must be a part of your artistic approach. How much do you, I guess, rely on a beat or a lyric? How much does music really play into your art form?
I find a lot of inspiration from it, but I haven't been able to work on a film that really was harnessing it as much as I would like. I think that's sort of what my desire for next is, to be honest with you. There are like a handful of filmmakers that the way the cinematography and blocking and everything is communicated is almost continuously in a rhythm, and they all sort of flow together. A couple filmmakers that work like that are Martin Scorsese and even David Fincher. Like almost if you watch David Fincher's films, they're like moving in a particular cadence in the edit. It's like a certain beat per minute, and like it's always moving in this particular way. But that's because he's creating a harmony between the edit, the acting, and the cinematography and the sound. So it's sort of like there's a lot of considerations going into that, and it is much more like you're watching a movie that's like a murder mystery or something, but it's actually a musical. You just don't realize it. And I haven't worked on a film quite like that, so that's sort of my ambition at the moment, is to find a film that is sort of working on a level where it is trying to harness the music of it. And it is much, even Paul Thomas Anderson's like Punch Drunk Love is like totally more musical than I think it's perceived to. It's not, I'm not saying it musical in the genre sense, but more like the way the camera moves and the actors are moving is all sort of in sort of a, like they're composing a song. And that would be my something I would like to explore in the future much more than I have in the past.
Can we ever expect maybe a directing feature from you?
It's hard for me to say no to anything like that. I don't have a, it's not my primary interest at the moment. I feel sad when I think about it, only because I see the directors having to deal with a lot more shit than the cinematographer has to deal with, and a lot of it has to do with politics. And if I ever had a desire to go down that road, it would have to be like I had such a strong will to proceed with that, because my tolerance for shit is really low. Do you know what I mean? Like I
Oh,
don't
yeah.
want I cringe at the idea of walking into a room and justifying something, you know, which a director has to do. And that's why Andrews even got Blonde financed, because he goes into those rooms and maybe he has like a really negative emotion and he thinks everyone's a fucking idiot. He'll say it, he'll express his feelings in such a beautiful way that by the time he leaves the room, everyone's gonna believe it. You know, it's like a type of charm. Whereas I don't know if I have those attributes intrinsically. It would be, maybe I do. I don't know. I'd never, it's not like I'm watching video of myself talking to others. I'm sort of just like judging myself from within. But I don't know if I've developed those skills. And if I don't have those skills, I'd have to have a uniquely strong will towards a project that I just knew had to be made. And I don't have that. I'm not a writer. So I don't know if I would ever direct anything, but like I said, the universe is infinite in its possibilities, so who knows?
Well, you have given us two of the most visually stunning films of the last 2 decades. So
Oh, thank you.
thank you for that. And thank you for coming on the show. It
Thank
really
you.
means a lot to me.
No, thank you. Thank you for inviting me, and I'm glad to have contributed.
Of course.
Awesome.
Thank you again. And I
Yeah.
wish you nothing but luck. You deserve the Oscar for this damn movie.
Oh,
It
thank
deserves to
you.
be on Criterion. It's
Oh, man.
absolutely fucking brilliant. So thank
Oh,
you.
appreciate. Thanks for the respect.
Thank you for listening. This concludes our broadcast day.